Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. A lot's been happening over the last 2 weeks, especially with Syria. Jim, one of the things I've been wondering about Syria is what historical precedents are there for this type of intervention from the United States where the president goes to Congress first before he intervenes? I know there was the Bush intervention. You know, he went and asked for permission before he went into Afghanistan and like that. But what other times in the U.S. history has a situation like this happened?
Well, none, actually. Since the War Powers Act became law decades ago, President has been careful not to, step over an imaginary line. Technically, the President still has constitutional authority to react to any immediate threat to the United States. The case being made, or wish thought could be made in Iraq, was there was no immediate threat. And he ought to get, you know, Congress on board. That was just like his father. His father always was careful to line all the ducks up, legally, constitutionally, before he took military action. And Obama could have, ignored this, but Congress, being Congress, said, hey, why not ask? He's reluctant to ask because basically Iraq didn't turn out as promised. These wars never do. And at the same time, you have a similar problem in Syria that you have in Iraq, where both countries have long been a refuge for all sorts of international terrorists. Syria more so than Iraq, actually. But this is complicated by the fact that Iraq sees Syria as becoming more of a terrorist threat to the Shia-dominated government in Iraq because that would provide a victory for the rebels, would provide a base for Sunni Islamic terrorists to support their compatriots in Iraq. And, of course, Iran and Saudi Arabia are fighting this religious war, Sunni versus Shia. Iran believes that it can win this. And Assad agrees, they just tough it out and keep killing Syrians until the majority of Syrians, give up, which may or may not happen. While a lot of Westerners agree with, the idea that the rebels should prevail, there's not unanimous agreement, again, because especially no American politician wants to be tagged as somebody who's getting us into another Iraq. The problem is that the Middle East is a mess. It has long been a mess. I mean, the piece I did on Syria on the 3rd pointed out the old Turkish wisdom. Do not involve yourselves with the problems of the Arabs. And it's Turks that definitely know because they ruled the place for about 500 years, and they were never happy with it. Indeed, there was no great opposition within Turkey when the Ottoman Empire came down in 1918, and they lost all of their Arab provinces, conquests. And, for most Turks, it was good riddance. But it's still a problem. Whether or not, it's going to be a greater problem if you bomb it or don't, the problem is not going to go away.
Austin?
Well, look, the president has constitutional authority, as Jim said, to react to an attack on the United States, and there's also leeway judgment in there with really the late 19th and then into the 20th century with more rapid communications and air power that he's got responding to air threats, certainly that rise after World War One. The Constitution, though, Dan, does say Congress gets to declare war. It does not have to say formally a declaration of war. It's Congress saying, okay, you've consulted us. Now, how do I know that? I've read enough discussion among constitutional lawyers. In fact, there was a piece yesterday that I read on the web, and one this morning from a couple of constitutional lawyers discussing it, and both of them had taken the position that the international lawyers who rely on formal declarations are not paying attention to the U.S. Constitutional requirements. Now, in our specific situation here with Syria, in my view, we have we lack clarity as to what the goals are. We have President Obama has not provided, in my opinion, strong leadership. I'm amazed. Yesterday in Stockholm, he told in a press conference that he did not establish a red line for the Assad regime. But if you go back and read the entire transcript of what he said August 20th in 2012, and I mean the entire transcript, because it's Chuck Todd of NBC who's asking him with a question, and you can see, you can hear this in audio, and I'm sure there's video out there as well. It is a red line. And he says there will be consequences, and he says it's a red line for us, meaning the United States. It's not an international community. It's why am I focusing on that? No, this is not partisan politics. This it's a astonishing thing, in my view, for the president of the United States, who is considering, strongly considering, last week he was all but certain to trigger it, what he called, or his at least his spokespeople within the administration, punitive strikes, which are acts of war on the Assad regime, to say that it's now the quote-unquote responsibility, the red line was established by the international community and the like. It is a, in my view, a wrong-headed way to go about building an international consensus, a political consensus, a diplomatic framework, as Jim noted what George W. Bush did, doing the same thing George H.W. Bush did. And George H.W. Bush, as Jim noted, was somebody who was paid a great deal of attention to some of the diplomatic framework for an intervention as best he could. That may have been reflecting his own experience in the United Nations, briefly with the Central Intelligence Agency, but George H.W. Bush was somebody who had broad experience in the international arena as a leader in special functional areas, and he understood them well across the board. What we have now is there was a red line. We can discuss whether striking Assad for employing probably G.B. Sarin is the right thing to do in terms of a punitive strike. U.S. credibility, President Obama's credibility, is on the line because President Obama put his credibility on the line. Is that a good reason to launch punitive strikes? My own opinion in this is I think damaging and degrading the Assad regime is a reasonable goal that's in the interests of the United States. And I also think, adding on to this, destroying or sending a message, but you'd have to destroy in order to send the effective message, his chemical delivery capabilities, if not some of his chemical weapon stocks, meaning the regimes, I'm personalizing and saying Assad, I think that is in, arguably, in U.S. interest. I do not think it is possible for the United States to do nothing especially now. I don't ever think it's really possible for the American president to do nothing in the international arena, because America itself is always doing something, Dan, whether it's the American government, but they're always, America's just too big. As Jim once said, when someone was criticizing something that we had written about, I think it was actually Cyprus. He pointed out, he says, this person didn't read Political Science 101. America already dominates the planet. It's not a question of, quote-unquote, American attempt to domination in a multi-spectrum sense, with all the power and all the capabilities the United States has and all the communications access. The United States is always doing something. The question is will a military strike have beneficial effects? Obama's gone to Congress belatedly. There are questions about the way the resolution went through the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. A number of very prominent senators who would, if there was a floor debate coming up at the end of this week, could, I'm not saying they will, I don't know their minds, could turn it into a discussion of why did you ram it through the Foreign Relations Committee when you came to get our opinion. And what's going to come out of this, or could come out of it, and I don't think this is good for President Obama if his attempt is to build a political consensus here in the United States, is you'll see the argument being made by some of the senators that voted against it, that this is simply a facade to blame if something goes wrong on Republicans. So I wrote a piece this week, Dan, that said this was a political quagmire. I think it's a quagmire.
Okay. Jim, where did the sarin gas come from?
Syria manufactures it. Making nerve gas is not technically difficult. It's basically a formulation of insecticide that affects mammals instead of insects. It does require you to, how should I put it, make the manufacturing process much more secure. You know, you can afford some insecticide leaks while you're manufacturing that stuff, but you cannot afford nerve gas leaks. But they did it. It's not that difficult to do it. You can manufacture insecticide. You can manufacture nerve gas without too much trouble. They are one of the few countries that has not signed the treaty, which the United States and Russia have signed and are carrying out, to get rid of all their chemical weapons. And indeed, one of the problems assuming Assad's government is overthrown, is to quickly get in there and destroy existing stocks, which is expensive, requires special incinerators, et cetera, and careful handling. I'm sure most Syrians would be, all for that, as would most of Syria's neighbors. In fact, a lot of them are becoming alarmed right now because they feel that Assad's next move might to be turn over, quantities of nerve gas to terrorist groups so they could go and basically carrying out more terrifying terrorist attacks in neighboring countries. Israel is particularly upset about that, but Israel can be more secure because their border is more secure. Countries like Jordan, Turkey, and even parts of Lebanon have to worry about that because so far terrorists have not gotten their hands on nerve gas. Indeed, the only terrorist use of nerve gas was by radical Buddhists in Japan in the 1990s. Go figure that one out. But that killed a lot of people. Not a lot, a couple of dozen. It made hundreds, very ill, some with long-lasting effects, neurological effects. But that was homemade, so to speak, nerve gas. The Syrian stuff is military-grade and thus much more dangerous.
Now, Austin, there were some rumors during the Iraq war that some of the stockpiles of Iraqi gas and chemical weapons made it to Syria. Is that part of their stockpile that they have?
Dan, I wish I knew. I know we all read in the open source reports that there were tank trucks moving suspicious material from Iraq to Syria just prior to the March 2003 attack. I don't know what to make of that. I want to point out something that Jim had said about the Japan attack. That was Aum Shinrikyo, and there were about a dozen deaths in that, but there were also about a thousand severe nerve agent poisoning casualties of people who didn't die. So this stuff is extremely powerful. Even if it doesn't kill you, the long-term effects can be there are long-term effects. And the ability to knock out a neighborhood, especially if you deliver it with 122 millimeter rockets, which is what the indication is that happened from the Assad regime, can be an immensely deadly and effective weapon if you're going to attack very good, very quickly or after you've launched the attack. You got to have your the troops who are launching the attack wearing protective masks and gear for it, but it's a real danger. It's a real danger, and it's a real danger to unprotected civilians.
Right. Jim, do we know if these stockpiles are scattered across the country, or are they concentrated in one location, or is there any intelligence that has been coming out on this?
Yeah, well, the Israelis and the United States have both monitored as best they can the location of the nerve gas. There are several other agents, you know, less lethal, but, you know, still legal. The original pre-war locations have changed in some cases as military bases were overrun by the rebels. As best we know, none of these stocks have been captured, but they have been put in motion. And that agitated the Israelis a great deal because they were afraid some of them were going to go across the border into Lebanon and into the hands of Hezbollah. But apparently even Iran is not keen on Hezbollah getting their hands on nerve gas because, as Iran has found, while Hezbollah is their client, they are not totally under control. They found that out in 2006 when Hezbollah triggered a brief border war with Israel. Iran does not want to enrage Israel to the point where it becomes a shooting conflict as opposed to right now basically a verbal one with occasional terrorist attacks. So Iran wants to win, but they don't want their gas in the hands of terrorists either.
Austin, it sounds like no matter what we do, we need to be prepared to somehow secure these weapons at some point in this conflict.
I don't know if secure is the right word. I guess it's okay. Monitor, destroy, I guess it's a form. Both all work into it. Better that they were not there, but they are there. Better that they were not have used. But look, Dan, for what it's worth, there was strong evidence in March of this year, 2013, that the Assad regime had used chemical weapons in the Aleppo area. It was, quote-unquote, not confirmed. If, again, sarin is non-persistent, it's hard to get absolute confirmation on the ground a week, 2 weeks, 30 days after an attack. And as Jim said a moment ago, it's kind of like pesticide for mammals, and it's built that you can make arguments, oh, no, you're just looking at something that was a pesticide, and those are pesticide residues. Imagine that in an apartment building, but, you know, that's the way that a dictatorship would make the argument. Get back to your point, yes, we have an interest. Israel has an interest. The civilized world has an interest in making certain that chemical weapons like sarin or VX, which is a persistent nerve agent, GD somain, which is another nerve agent. I'm not sure that Syria has GD. There's been evidence, actually, since the late some discussion since the late 70s that they have it, early 80s, perhaps. we have to monitor it. We don't want it to fall in the hands of Al-Qaeda. And as Jim pointed out, Iran is not really interested in seeing it fall in the hands of even Hezbollah, which is its subsidiary organization, because who knows where it would go and how it would be used.
Right. Jim, are there any good guys in Syria? We hear about the radical groups. We hear about Assad. Is there a good group someplace in there?
Well, yes, there is a mainstream rebel organization which is increasingly estranged from the al-Nusra and other Islamic radical organizations. The problem is that while the mainstream, the pro-democracy rebels have the numbers, they don't have the fighting spirit. They're not fanatics. As the terrorists like to point out, it's not enough to want to kill. It's more important to be willing to die. And the radicals, the Al-Qaeda affiliated groups, are more willing to die, and they are responsible for the terror attacks, which are one of the things that triggered the Syrian use of nerve gas, because the Damascus suburb that the nerve gas attack fell on was pro-rebel. And it was basically the base for a lot of the continuing terrorist attacks into Damascus itself. And that's obviously very worrying to the Assad government, which has tried to shield its core supporters, especially in Damascus, from the fact that there was even a war going on. This is becoming harder and harder to avoid. And Iran is in a big hurry to wrap this whole thing up, because they are basically subsidizing the Assads with money they don't really have. The Iranians have lost over half their oil income in the last year, and that's not getting any better. I mean, that's one victory that doesn't get much publicity. But we are managing to continue to, despite all the zigging and zagging the Iranians are doing to avoid the sanctions, to keep them in place, and especially to keep them blocked out of the international banking system. So in that, there is a victory. The victories aren't news. And the Iranians want to, get a victory, defeat the rebels, so they don't have to spend all this money, because basically the Iranians are eventually going to run out. Next year or so, the way things are going, it's going to be a financial crisis and political crisis inside Iran and inside Syria, because eventually the Iranians are going to have to cut off that subsidy, and that's going to be an enormous blow to the Assads, because basically the main thing that's keeping the Assads, in business right now is a fairly large mercenary army that the Iranians have purchased by recruiting, Shia volunteers in Iraq and Lebanon. And, of course, they subsidize and pay for Hezbollah. And they had to basically give Hezbollah more money, because the Hezbollah involvement in Syria is not popular inside Lebanon. And there's a risk of the civil war in Lebanon reigniting. That civil war went from 75 to 1990. It's basically only been a ceasefire since then, because what was left in place was this huge Shia militia. The Shia are, the largest minority in Lebanon, and they were always the poorest. And it was the Syrian support in the 1980s that got Hezbollah going, but basically armed and equipped the Shia so they could basically hold their own. Since then, the Lebanese Shia, led by Hezbollah, have been trying to take over the country, which is the democracy. The majority of Lebanese have sort of gone along with all this nonsense from Hezbollah. They don't like it, but they're united by, hatred of Israel, the usual nonsense. And they don't want another civil war. But that's changing, with more and more violence inside Lebanon directly related to the fighting in Syria, and especially Hezbollah involvement in Syria. So the clock is ticking on this.
Dan, let me make a quick comment on that, because that's a great point. One of the big risks that Iran took and Assad regime took and Lebanese Hezbollah took was the introduction of Lebanese Hezbollah, as Jim called them, mercenaries, that's what they are, into Syria to prop up the Assad regime. That hurt Lebanese Hezbollah immensely in Lebanon, because one of the ways they had kind of, sort of, reached a modus vivendi with the other Lebanese factions was that we're we're here in Lebanon, and our mission is to, quote-unquote, confront the Israelis. Jim alluded to that. Well, no. Iran has poured, and there's 2 years ago, I read a piece that said that it was an estimate that Iran had poured over $5 billion worth of weapons and money for training into Lebanese Hezbollah since, roughly 2000, 2001, 2002. It was those kinds of resources that gave Lebanese Hezbollah the power inside Lebanon to do what Jim said they were doing politically. Well, their quote-unquote cover story's been blown. They've moved a lot of their fighters into Syria. The resentment of the other groups, Sunnis, other Shia factions, Druze, not to mention the Christians, not to mention the Armenians and a few of the other groups that you have, confessional groups and ethnic groups in Lebanon. Now's the time to deal with the Lebanese Hezbollah leadership. That's what the other factions see. They sense an opportunity. And as Jim says, increasing violence, it's going on. I would say that Lebanon is already, it was always in a low-grade civil war. It's in a now, it's above simmered, Dan.
Jim, what do you think Syria's reaction will be if we go ahead and perform some sort of strike, or the U.S. perform some sort of strike against them?
Well, I think the worst thing that can happen to Syria is that their air defenses will be revealed to be pretty shabby. I mean, everybody's been very touch and go about that because nobody knows for sure. The Israelis have, destroyed the Syrian air defense systems in the past. But they are very careful. I mean, nobody's absolutely sure just how good it is, and either the Israelis or anybody else really would like to risk it unless they absolutely have to. We did a piece last week in the strategy page where we pointed out that the United States has apparently learned from the Israelis the 5 attacks the Israelis have made inside of Syria this year were all apparently carried out launched outside of Syrian airspace using, long-range guided missiles. We have plenty of those, not just cruise missiles, but also powered JDAMs. And we've been developing those over the last 10 years. They are in service. So we could launch, thousands of weapons, literally, into Syria without entering Syrian airspace. So it would do a great deal of damage. And if we had to, we could do a siege, a suppression of enemy air defense, type campaign, using minimal manned aircraft, but there would be some risk. But the basic thing is, any air attack on Syria would not get many Americans killed. What people are worried about is boots on the ground, but what people forget is that the air support in Libya caused very few casualties to the NATO air forces. I don't think there were any Americans killed. I mean, there was one aircraft came down, through mechanical failure. So we're not talking about American lives. We're talking about American commitment.
Right.
Oh, well, we're talking about American capital as well. General Dempsey, end of July, Congress asked him, it was actually Senator McCain, and I forget the other senator, specifically said, give us what your options are. And he came up with 5 options that were unclassified. I actually wrote a column about it, and I think we discussed it on a strategy talk, Dan, at least a little bit. I thought they were reasonable expression of the options. But in each one of them, he gave a rough estimate of risk, but also cost. Costs of an air operation like this, in terms of over and above daily operational costs, tough to estimate. But if you're talking about, and Jim can put some figures to this as well, volleys of 200 to 300 Tomahawk land attack missiles, numerous JDAMs, other ordinance for suppressing and destroying Syria's brittle air defense system, you're starting to look at several billion dollars.
Yes, exactly.
Several billion dollars. And, again, the U.S. has the capacity to do it. This is, in some ways, and Jim didn't use the word minor operation, but he said, you know, you can do this. This is a doable operation, and General Dempsey has said that. Interestingly enough, I did listen to his I read and listened to part of his comments on Tuesday, and he did say that, you know, some of the things that we wanted to strike, indicating that's why I said delivery units have moved, but we've kept tabs on them, and I'm thinking, yeah, the Israelis have helped us and the Turks have helped us. Okay, we know where they are, but the bottom line was we can do this. But, and then this is I'll cede to Jim on this because I want to hear what he has to say about the billions. You've got the issue going on here, Dan, too, of the sequester costs. Will the inventory of Tomahawk land attack missiles, is there a commitment on Congress's part, the administration's part, to reconstitute those, build more, resupply? I don't know. Jim, go ahead after when I said billions.
Yeah, we're talking several billion, you know, not just the cost of the munitions. The cruise missiles are over $1 million apiece. The powered JDAMs, the JSRO and JASSM, they're up to $500,000 apiece. The cheaper ones are 100,000 each. And military want to replace those in case there's a unpleasantness in Korea or someplace else. But there's also a major expense in the wear and tear on the aircraft, since our aircraft are getting older and they were pretty much worn down rapidly during the last decade because of operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. So that would be expensive. And again, because of the sequester, you know, the military's been forced to, you know, finally cut some corners. And the Air Force would probably, you know, they're already starting to do early retirement on a lot of the existing F-15s and F-16s. And that would accelerate. But again, it's not a breaking the bank, you know, type of operation. And I think the biggest danger that people see is getting us deeper into a yet another, you know, long drawn out war. And everybody's saying, you know, with some justification, well, Libya, we were lucky, mainly because we got other NATO countries to do the actual fighting. We supplied a lot of refueling aircraft, a lot of electronic, you know, reconnaissance aircraft and things like that. But we basically let the Europeans do the fighting. They don't want to do it this time.
Well,
the French do, but, you know, not to the extent that they did it in Libya. And there's also the problem of the blowback, because with the Arabs, you can blame if you help and you can blame if you don't.
Dan, let me make one comment. I'm looking at the time here, too, on it.
Yeah.
But Europeans don't want to engage other than France. And as Jim has pointed out in the past, that France has a long-term, multi-century interests in the Levant, Lebanon, and Syria. It's really not surprising in many ways that France was the U.S. coalition partner in the plans for the initial punitive strikes, but Obama administration and President Hollande of France. But Syria does border on Turkey. Turkey's a NATO nation. And twice in public, I know he's done it more than this, Prime Minister Erdogan in Turkey has said he's considered invoking Article 5 because of attacks across the border, and they were proven up, the fire from pro-regime forces into Turkey. In one case, I think two Turks were killed, woman and a teenager, and another one wounded. I mean, you know, whether it's incidental fire or the indications were the Turkish military decided it was incidental fire, even though they did return fire in a couple of other cases. They pounded with artillery and returned fire on some mortar positions. Again, my source on that was a Turkish English language newspaper. That said, the big deal here is that you've got a NATO nation, And getting back to the use of chemical weapons, the Turks are concerned, and legitimately so. It may seem a stretch to think that Assad might do it, but what happens to the Turkish government? They've got to think about their own domestic political situation. If it is used, and 300 or 400 Turks are killed and 1,000 injured by a chemical weapons attack. Now, does that bring NATO into a war with Syria? Of course it does. That's Article 5. I know this is kind of a far-out scenario, but I guarantee you this has been thought about in here in the United States, been thought about at Ankara, and it's been thought about at NATO, and it's been talked about. It's been talked about.
Yeah. Well, we've run out of time. We could probably discuss this for multiple hours, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it again. I'm sure we'll watch what happens over the next couple of weeks in Congress with rapt attention. We'll talk to you both next time.
Bye, Dan.
Thanks.
Bye.